Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As we turn the page and consider Yah's testimony, we do need to, in the name of full disclosure and fairness, make a comment on the commercial sponsor of the news segment from Salem Radio. As it relates to Christian Mingle, this is our editorial comment.
Find God's match for you, the way we did.
Join today.
That's just stupid!
Thank you very much. And it is. And it is stunning that that this business is claiming that God is specifically interacting with their software to find marriage partners for Christians. That they are so successful that they're buying ads in record numbers. They're one of the largest advertisers now in the country. And that means that their message, which is utterly stupid, which demeans God, which is absolutely wrong, is resonating with a very wide cross-section of Americans. That Christians are so ignorant, so irrational, so dumbed down, so misled in terms of the nature and priorities of God, the character of God, that they actually believe this. And, you know, what's the redneck comedy crew's retort to that? You know, here's your sign. Wear it on your forehead. You are stupid. We were considering yesterday why the instruction that Yah etched in stone is the extraordinarily important instruction following the admonition that we should highly value our Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother, following the most important of the seven instructions, which is that we should set the Shabbat apart, hold it as special, to recognize the role that it plays in our relationship with Yahweh. God asked us not to make a habit of killing. You know, the news in the first hour where we continue to send drones to kill individuals who are engaged in their religion. Well, the religion is stupid. We ought not be making a habit of killing them. When we make a habit of killing them, they make a habit of killing us. It is also stupid. But one of the things we do learn is that there is a time and a place where eliminating the hosts of political and religious stupidity is actually an appropriate thing to do. And we've given this example before as the children of Israel had completed their exodus and were about to enter the promised land, the home of God on earth. And before they did so, Yahweh said, you know, there's some rats in there and they're infected with a horrible disease. They are a host of a deadly plague that if you do not eradicate the host of this plague, this pandemic, that your children and your children's children will succumb to this illness, they're going to die. And understand that the hosts of this deadly plague, their iniquity, their corruption, their perversion, this disease within them has reached a limit that there is no hope for them. They're all going to die. The best that can be said for them is their souls will be extinguished in just a matter of years. And many of them allowed to continue to fester in this horrible pandemic disease and this deadly plague will become pontificators, advocates of the plague, and as a result of that will be separated from me enduring eternity in Sheol. The most moral, the most rational thing you can do is to rid the host of this disease from my home. And I want you to understand how religion in this regard and political customs in this regard are deadly. And so Yahweh said, their perversity and sin of twisting and distorting, a wone, the depravity of perverting and manipulating, of deviating from the way, was complete, Salem, total. Now, Yahweh used the same word just eight statements ago in Shemoth 25. There we were told that Awon, the perversity of twisting and distorting, of corrupting, is reckoned against the children, preventing them from obtaining Yahweh's mercy. God is explaining here the issues of life and death and those things that rob people of their life. Now, it's quite different if you're God and you say, this is my home because it is his home. He created the universe and he created the planet Earth. And so if he says that a tiny fraction of the Earth is going to represent my home, and he created life, so he can also say, because I gave them their mortal existence, and I know for certain that none of them are going to transcend their mortal existence, not in a positive way, I want you to foreshorten their mortality. He's in a very different position than any of us are. And God's instructions in terms of wiping out the hosts of the religion and political poison that corrupts were for a very specific place, only Yisrael, at a very specific time, a number of cities within Yisrael during the end of the Exodus for about a 20 or 30 year period. That's it. There are no open-ended instructions to do this any other place or ever again. But it does tell you why the instruction was written, don't make a habit of killing. You know what? Back nearly 5,000 years ago, recognized that the iniquity, the perversion, the corruption of humankind through religion and politics and societal customs had reached such a level that there was no hope for the vast preponderance of people, that if he didn't reset the equation and wipe out those humans with a nesama who were using their conscience to corrupt others and start again fresh with a cleansing of a flood, that there was not going to be the opportunity, the hope that he envisioned so that thousands of people could walk to him in love and avail themselves of the benefits of his covenant. So he cleansed the earth, at least the region where men existed with a nesama. And he demonstrated this same ideal in the Promised Land when his children were about to enter. And he will do it once again when he returns and he restores the earth back to the conditions of the Garden of Eden. Three times. Doesn't make a habit of killing. It's not an ongoing phenomenon, and he is the author of life after all. But it is the reason why the instruction was written in the imperfect. Because God cannot violate his own instructions. Yahweh is extraordinarily unique in that he not only talks the talk, he walks the walk. Everything that applies to us applies to him. And so this instruction, like all the others, was written in the imperfect, which says that we should not continuously, habitually, on an ongoing basis, kill. And sometimes people wonder why God allowed, you know, the Nazis to rise to power and therefore kill so many millions of people. And it's because that God does not make a habit of killing. Man does, however, but God does not. God will not violate his own standards, which is why the instruction was written in the imperfect. Now, the next instruction, which is the fourth of seven on the second of two tablets, is also problematic on the surface, compelling us to consider its deeper spiritual insights. It says, you shouldn't make a habit of committing adultery. You shouldn't continue to commit adultery. It is lo na'ap, just two words, negation, followed by the verb na'ap, scribed in the second person, making it you. It was written also in the imperfect. It said, you know, you should not be unfaithful. You should never have relations with more than one marriage partner. Na'af adultery differs from zana, which is illicit heterosexual relations. So God is not addressing here the having sex with someone who you are not married to when you are married. If he wanted to prioritize adultery to the top 10 list, he would not have used na'af. If he was talking about a sexual act, he would have used zana. He didn't use zana, he used na'af. So he's speaking of something that is germane to relationships, fidelity, trust, exclusivity in a relationship. He's hearkening back to the first two statements he etched in stone. You will not exist with another God in my presence. I, Yahweh, am your Savior. I don't want you to pay homage to religious and political symbols. So he is using the na'af here, adultery, as the fourth of seven statements to speak of fidelity, of monogamy in the covenant relationship. Covenant not only is the Hebrew word for family relationship, it is also, bereth is the Hebrew word for marriage vow. That is what's being spoken of here. It is the prime directive, the covenant, and Yahweh is saying, don't screw it up. If you become like Yisrael during the time of Hosea, and you continue to chase after gods of man's making, as humankind has done with their Lord Jesus Christ, with Allah, with men elevated to divine status, he says, if you do that, then I will determine that you have committed adultery relative to the covenant. You have na'af. And as a result of that, I will divorce you. And since Yahweh is God alone, since he is the source of life, when we are divorced because of our illicit behavior, it's over. We are mortal. We will die. Our souls will cease to exist. We had the opportunity. We blew it. And that's the reason why Christianity and Islam and socialist secular humanism are so deadly, is they cause so many to blow it. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As we continue to consider the merits of Yah's instructions and recognize some very insightful things, that here the fourth of seven instructions is a request that we don't continuously commit adultery. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that Abraham, Jacob, and Dod, the three of perhaps the three most important figures in the Torah, even Moshe, had multiple wives. Now, Abraham had multiple wives. Jacob had many, many wives. And Dod had a whole harem full of wives. And while Yahweh neither endorses nor recommends that behavior, and I would strongly discourage it based upon Yah's model, his exemplar, his testimony, Yahweh doesn't explicitly condemn polygamy either. And the reason is that God doesn't want us to lose sight of the fact that what's at stake here is the covenant relationship with him. He didn't etch this statement in stone because illicit sexual relations was a top 10 item on his list. God has very little to say in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms about our behavior sexually. And he says, in the midst of the Torah, he says, listen, I'm going to give you some instructions here that are just some baseline understandings. You know, you ought not commit bestiality. It's really degrading when you try to have sex with animals. Don't do that. He said that you ought not engage in any form of incest. Not with your mom, not with your daughter, not with your niece. Don't do that. That is really a bad idea. Nothing good is going to come of that, and lots of bad stuff. Don't do that. He then says that, you know, you ought not engage in homosexual sex. That's not healthy. You just ought not do that because the purpose of you being a sexual creature and of falling in love and having that be a wonderful component of your relationship with your spouse and part of the enjoyment of marriage and home and family is that you can be productive and you can conceive children in this way. No, you can't do that in a homosexual act. It corrupts the model. And God says, don't do that. I don't want you to do that. That's not healthy for you. But it's interesting when it comes to wanting a divorce. You know, it's very straightforward. He says, just write it down. Say, I want a divorce and present it. That's it. Nothing more to it. Now, there's this is a fairly elaborate story about if a woman divorces her husband and marries somebody else and then wants to go back to her original husband. There's some issues there, but they're all designed to shed light on the nature of the Torah and the value of this relationship and how God expects us to respond or hopes that we will respond, just wants us to respond to the covenant. So the very first thing you have to recognize in this instruction is that God's not talking about sex. He's not caught up on it. This whole puritanical view of what you have to do to be godly is Pauline. It's a messed up, screwed up, twisted, deprivation-based system that's designed to control and influence people. That's Pauline. God's just not preoccupied with that the way Paul was. And so God's instructions are pretty simple. I've shared most everything he has to say about sexual behavior. He did not use zana, which would be the sexual term for having a heterosexual relationship that's extraneous to one's marriage vows. He didn't use that. He's speaking of his relationship with us. He knows that we are imperfect and that we will breach that relationship. He knows it. I've done it. My guess is that all of you have done it as well. He just says, don't make a practice of it. Don't make a habit of it. I can resolve the flaws so long as they are not ingrained in you so much part of your fabric that you identify yourself with the adultery. By calling yourself a Christian, by calling yourself a Mormon, by calling yourself a socialist, secular humanist. Don't do that. Just don't make a habit of it. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yadam. Throughout Yah's testimony, we are confronted with a stark reality that multiple wives multiply a man's problems. That's why the Yah's testimony is just so real. You know, he talks about the consequence of having multiple wives. When you look at Jacob's life and all of the infighting that he had to endure. You know, you look at what happened and all of the issues related to Abraham when he decided that based upon his wife's suggestion that he use Hagar as a means to deliver a son. And then all of the internal turmoil within that household. Yeah, God's pretty clear that having multiple wives is a good way to multiply a man's problems. Now, that's not to say that a wife is a problem. I love my wife, and my wife is a great blessing and a great joy in my life. But one wife is wonderful. Two wives would not be so good. In fact, two wives would be a very bad thing, and that's what Yah's testimony tells us. One's good, two is not better. And so as we read Yah's intent, what he thinks is the best advice, we find it in Bereshit, Genesis 2:24, when he says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, and he will be united with his wife." Singular, not wives, plural. "And they will become one flesh," not two, three, four, or more. Further, in Devarim 17:14-20, which is Deuteronomy in your pagan Bibles, Yahweh tells us that royalty should not multiply their wives. Just a chapter removed from the three statements and seven instructions, God provides insights for those who take another woman to assure that they are not mistreated. Now, turning to Hosea 2:2. Here is what we learn. It says, "Rebuke, rib, quarrel with, and be in a state of hostility, be in opposition and contend with your mother, bringing a lawsuit forth to prosecute her." He's speaking to Yisrael. "For she is not my wife, and neither am I her husband. Let her therefore turn away from illicit relationships with false deities," Zanum, "away from her presence, for I will not love her children, for they are the children of prostitution," of idolatry, of false deities. "For their mother wantonly committed adultery and idolatry," Zana. "She who conceived them made a serious mistake." Yahweh is looking here at Yisrael as being the mother of the covenant's children. You know, just as Jacob was renamed Yisrael, and he's speaking to Ephraim, which is the northern kingdoms, exclusive of the two tribes in the south, Yehuda and Benjamin. And he's saying that Yisrael was unfaithful, that Yisrael went out and had illicit relationships with false deities. And as a result, that the children should prosecute their mothers. They should quarrel with them and say, "What in the world is wrong with you? Why do you do that? You ought not be having a religious affair with any god, especially these pagan gods of man's making. Don't do that." God is explaining the statement that he etched in stone. So Yahweh divorced himself from Yisrael because Yisrael was unfaithful and chased after other gods. And as always the case, the children were corrupted as a consequence of corrupt religious schemes. This instruction, therefore, serves to explain Yahweh's use of jealousy in the context of not tolerating a rival. You know, the second of the three statements on the first of two tablets said that I am a jealous God. And he explains it in the context of religion corrupting children. He wants nothing more than for us to love him. But not if that love is devalued by our devotion to a deity of man's making. Now, on the surface, the instruction provides sound advice. We should be faithful in our marriage because it is honorable, honest, moral, loving, and beneficial. And if our home and our marriage mirrors the covenant, this is a very good thing. But once again, the primary message is spiritual, not superficial. There is only one God and one way to him. Now, moving on to the next of the seven instructions. This is the fifth most important of those seven. He says, you should not make a practice of stealing. You should not continuously take from others without their permission. This is Shemoth names, Exodus 20:15. Ganab is the verb here, negated by lo. Clarified by the imperfect conjugation, telling us that it's the ongoing practice of stealing. You know, my guess is that virtually everyone at some point has taken something maybe inconsequential that belonged to someone else. And what God is saying here is, yeah, I know you're imperfect. And my Torah exists to resolve those imperfections, to perfect you, particularly my children. But if you make a practice of taking what doesn't belong to you, then there is no way that I want you in my home. There's no way that I can resolve this issue because your attitude is inappropriate. And so God says here, you should not make a practice, make a habit of stealing. Therefore, you shouldn't act like the U.S. government that continually confiscates the productivity of its citizens. Should not do that. That's wrong. Ganav speaks of taking something which does not belong to us by stealth, not by force, always without consent, and usually without knowledge. It smacks of deceit, of outwitting one's victim, and cheating them out of something valuable, and then carrying it away. Now, while this admonition condemns the basis of Islam, which is a religion based upon burglary, condemns the basis of Islam, where the religion was originally founded via kidnapping, and these things are done in Shemoth, Exodus 22:2 and 21:16. There is more to Ganav than kidnapping for ransom and terrorism-based piracy. The spiritual meaning of this divine edict is presented in Job. It's a book we don't very often turn to, but because Job is kind of out of the ordinary flow of the chronology of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Job 21:16 through 19 speaks of stealing someone away. An aspect here of Ganav is addressed in that context. So let's listen to what we can learn. It says the counsel, plans, and schemes, the purpose and the advice of the condemned, are far from me. This is Job speaking. As when the lamp of the wicked is snuffed out, calamity and destruction comes upon them, and the unfavorable circumstances of pain and anguish. In an angry rage and in hostility. They are brittle, they're lifeless stubble, these that are so disingenuous according to Yahweh, brittle and lifeless stubble. Before the presence of the Spirit, like chaff they are carried away by the whirling winds. God conceals and protects His children and watches over healing and repairing their vigor, making Him known to them. Ganav here was used in the, they like chaff are carried away. They're deceived, they're kidnapped by the whirling wind. This is supa. And so God is describing the nature of Ganav. That's to take people away. And who are they being equated to, and what is the mechanism from taking them away, and who are they being taken away from? When you understand those things, you'll understand the statement that Yah etched in stone. Well, it's the chaff. What is the chaff? It's the worthless, the dried up, the lifeless part of grain. Grain is symbolic of saved souls. The chaff is the part that is useless, that is lifeless, that is easily consumed in the fire and blown by the winds. It's the chaff that's carried away. Ganav. From whom? From God. By whom? The whirling wind. Supa is from suf, that which causes someone to perish in the end. Circular reasoning. You know, spirit in Hebrew is synonymous with the word for wind. It's something that you cannot see, but you can feel, that's outside, that affects you, changing your world. And there are tempest winds that are circular winds that are destructive. And there's the winds that blow in the rains and that send us the spirit of Yahweh. And so there are trade winds that are fortuitous, and there's circular storms, hurricanes, and tornadoes that are destructive. And the circular wind, the spirit of circular reasoning, is Hasatan. And he blows the chaff away from God. That's the meaning of Ganab and how it is explained. And it says he does so by snuffing out lives of the wicked and having them stumble in the dark through counsel and plans and schemes, which are a million miles away from those that the teachings of Yahweh and his Torah. And that they bring about calamity and destruction and unfavorable circumstances and pain and anguish and great hostility. And that's what God is saying here when he says, you should not make a habit of stealing. That's what religions and politics do. They steal. They take souls away from God. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So as we consider Yahweh's explanation in Yob of Ganab and what it means to be carried away, and Yahweh saying we should not make a habit of carrying people away from him, we recognize that those being carried away are like chaff. They're the dead and useless, the dry, easily blown away aspects of grain, the residual part of grain that has no value. And what God is saying in essence is that religious and political corruption enables those to engage in these things and who promote them to steal souls away from God. Chaff and stubble are the antithesis of purified grain, which is the metaphor throughout Yah's testimony for saved souls, and represents those whose lives are wasted, they're snuffed out, ultimately blown away, ceasing to exist, after being deceived by the adversary's false light. But the termination of life is a superior state that awaits those who purposefully plan to lead people astray. These schemers will be condemned, earning the unfavorable circumstance of eternal anguish for their animosity towards God. Therefore, the spiritual message behind the fifth of seven statements on the second of two tablets serves as a continuance of God's overt condemnation of religious deception that he got deep into in his prologue to these instructions. We're not to steal souls away from God. This is the message also of the third statement that Yahweh has done that first tablet. Don't do things that are deceitful and destructive in the name of Yahweh, your God, which are lifeless and cause people to be, their lives to be snuffed out for naught. This known, we shouldn't steal anything from anybody. And Paul, Muhammad, and Machiavelli were wrong in saying that the ends justify the means. But that's not the primary issue here. God does not want us to take people's souls by encouraging them to be religious or political. Now, the sixth of seven divine prescriptions continues with the same theme, and as has been the case with every one of these previous statements, the instruction was written here now in the call imperfect. There was no imperative associated with this. It's not a commandment. The call perfect talks about the relationship between the individuals on both sides of the verb. And it speaks of ongoing, unfolding behavior that becomes habitual in our lives. And so Yahweh says, Lo ana ba rea seker ed. You should never respond and testify against your neighbor. as a deceptive or misleading witness. Ed is used throughout Yah's testimony. It conveys eternal witness, restoring testimony. Ed is both eternal. It is also restoring. It is witness or testimony. Don't deceive or mislead with your Ed, your witness. Now, there's only one way that you can assure that your witness is not deceptive or misleading. Convey what Yahweh said. If your witness is based upon his testimony, you will never succumb, provide false, clever, mistaken, vain, or unreliable testimony. God does not want us to lie. He doesn't want us to deceive. He doesn't want us to act like Paul or Muhammad and beguile people into believing that they are speaking for God when in fact they're speaking for Hasatan. Don't do that. When you provide deceptive and misleading testimony as a witness, you cause enormous pain. Between the two charlatans that we just mentioned, billions, 3, 4, 5 billion souls have been squandered as a direct result of those two men responding and testifying against their neighbor in a deceptive and misleading way as a witness. So once again, God's saying, don't do that. Don't make it a practice. I understand that you're not perfect and that occasionally you will say things that aren't true. But here's the solution. When you find that you have conveyed something that's not true, correct the record. Be willing to say, you know, that wasn't entirely accurate. Now, based upon what I know, here's the truth. And if you want to share the truth and you always want to bear a truthful witness, then share what Yahweh shared with us. We'll return tomorrow.